This is North South.
Asim Kawakami here for the North and South podcast with my co-host, who's frankly a Japanese celebrity by now. Not, he's not a celebrity in America or Los Angeles. He's the LA Times, Dylan Hernandez. But we respect that. We need that. We need big Japanese community support for Dylan Hernandez, as always. But we will start. We got to start with the Super Bowl. We haven't really talked about, certainly not the result of it, certainly not what happened in that game, and the aftermath. I think, you know, we're several days removed from the game, so we don't have to talk specifically about the game. Unless Dylan wants to bring it up, there's certainly controversies about that game. But the 49ers pretty quickly fire Steve Wilks, and it wasn't exactly because of what happened in that game. I think that had something to do with it, with Shanahan not liking some of the play calls, had to call timeout in overtime because he didn't like a play call. Maybe Nick Bosa's comments about them not being prepared for the Mahomes keepers on two huge plays had something to do with it, or at least were reflections of their feelings about Steve Wilks. Now they go off on a defensive coordinator search, and there's some talk, Dylan Hernandez, that their leading candidate could be former Chargers coach Brandon Staley. And you know my feelings about Brandon Staley. You know Brandon Staley. Is this the ultimate fit? Is this the perfect candidate to save the 49ers defense?
I mean, look, when Staley had talent with the Rams, right? I mean, they had the best defense in the NFL. I mean, it's basically what got him the Chargers job. You know, to be honest, I mean, I was kind of, right, surprised that, you know, and again, right, obviously you guys have kind of the local perspective. You guys watch these teams like a lot closer, you know, kind of as a, you know, like a complete neutral here in terms of both geography, you know, and stuff like that. You know, obviously a bunch of my colleagues and I were watching this game together, and it was just a great game, right? And looked like both teams played well. You know, it's one of those things, hey, somebody's got to lose. And so I was, I guess, a little bit surprised, like, wait, they fired a guy after that game? You know, quite understanding, I guess, right? That, you know, again, we haven't been following this on a week-by-week basis, obviously, like you guys have. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess it kind of speaks, I guess, right, to the kind of standard, I guess, right, just kind of where the Niners are right now. You know, obviously different teams have different standards for, like, what's acceptable. You know, you're going for, like, a Super Bowl. Yeah, those things, you know, whatever they saw that they didn't like, obviously that's big enough of a deal for them, right? I mean, you're in the middle of the standings, probably doesn't get you fired, you know? So can Staley be that guy? I mean, again, he was with the Rams, you know, and I do think that on the Rams, you know, I think with the Chargers, kind of as time went on, you know, maybe the players kind of started losing kind of the belief in, you know, in him, right? Just both as a person, you know, and kind of as a strategist, you know, with the Rams, he wasn't there that long, right? And at least like during that time, my sense was that they kind of bought in, you know? And so, yeah, you know, I don't know, you know, was a good X's and O's guy. I mean, that said, you know, we did see with the Chargers, I mean, he even brought in his own guys, right? He had time certainly to turn that defense around, and it never quite did, you know? So you kind of look back at that Rams era and you kind of wonder, well, how much of that was like Aaron Donald, right? I mean, it really helps when one guy is going to take up two or three, you know, blockers at a time, which is kind of what you had with Donald. So yeah, I don't, you know, it's certainly an interesting call. I mean, just, you know, yeah, I don't, to be honest, I don't know, you know,
it's kind of a short answer. Yeah. Yeah. I surprised you with that one, and we can tell Dylan's surprised by that one. I am, you know, Joey Bosa connection, and I did talk to, you know, their father, Nick, and Joey's father about Nick, and he had not a lot of nice things to say about just the Brandon Staley era there, how happy he was that Harbaugh was a coach. Finally, they got a good coach. So that might be interesting, knowing how important, you know, Nick Bosa, his voice, his opinion matters in that locker room. He's certainly an incredible player. But maybe it's okay. And again, I don't think Staley's a bad defense corner. I think he's a good defense corner. He comes from the Fangio school, and they almost hired Fangio a couple times. That actually was Shanahan's first choice back in 2017 and couldn't get him. And that's when they went with Robert Saleh, worked very well. DeMeco Ryans obviously worked very well. And then Steve Wilks came in, not part of the system, not from that scheme and the personality didn't really fit. It was just kind of through the whole season, and it looks bad to do it like this. And it definitely feels like a scapegoating, and it is partially a scapegoating for a Super Bowl loss. But I do believe if you're ready to move on, don't delay it just for PR purposes. Just do it. Take the hit, and they're taking a hit, and they should get a hit. This was not a good thing for them, losing a Super Bowl and looking like they're blaming the defensive coordinator, whose defense played pretty well, by the way, against Patrick Mahomes, just not at the end, when they had already lost Dre Greenlaw to an Achilles tear. So I'm not a Brandon Staley guy. I just think he looks for the PR stuff. Like, the whole contrary to what I just said, he feels like a PR guy. He feels like he's always looking to look good. He's always looking to look at me, Twitter. I'm doing these bold things. And maybe as a defensive coordinator, it doesn't matter as much as it did when he was head coach, making those gutty fourth down decisions. Bill Barnwell from ESPN is going to tweet about how great I am. That part I did not like. But schematically, if he can figure out exactly what to do with Nick Bosa and not screw around with him, because if he starts screwing around with Nick Bosa, there will be trouble. There will be problems. I think it could begin. I don't know that's who they're going to hire. It's just a name that has sort of emerged. I thought it was going to be somebody from the Seattle system. Maybe they don't have someone. Gus Bradley, defensive coordinator now. The Colts might not. Who's defensive coordinator? The Jets might not be available. They're kind of parallel moves. So, Brandon Staley's unemployed. Maybe you give it a year, and then, as I kind of semi-joked, if it doesn't work, Robert Saleh probably is going to be available next year, if I had a guess on that, and you can bring Saleh back. But it's just a fascinating, yet another North and South crossover, Dylan, stuff that we come across all the time. If Brandon Staley moves up from the Chargers, it would be a very interesting thing, and to see how he deals with it, see how he, does he try to be Mr. I'm everything, if that's who the 49ers hire. Shanahan's never really had a guy like that, who brings his own. Would he bring in his own assistants? I don't think they'd want him to. I think they like their assistants. So, Chris Kocurek, defensive line coach, is like the most important assistant coach on the staff. He's a defensive line coach. So, all those things being said, it would be fascinating. We'd have a lot to talk about on the North and South podcast, and we're always in favor of that, Dylan. We're always in favor of that. What did you think about the hubbub, or even just the decision for Shanahan to take the ball to start overtime? And his post game said they didn't know all the overtime rules, which I'll just say offhand, I thought was a ridiculous amount of Super Bowl mania reporting that didn't have anything to do with anything. But you go ahead, Dylan, you tell me.
To be honest, it kind of felt, I don't know. I think the bigger trouble to me was, at halftime when, the lead was, 10-3, I think you kind of wanted to be up 20-something at that point, not that you can, obviously Chiefs are a good team. That's not going to happen. But, to me, like those overtime calls, I can see the logic, honestly, in taking the ball first, right? Both teams score. Hey, then it turns into a sudden death game, right? And you got the ball. That's what you want. I'm not really sure that's what kind of lost them the game. Just kind of the broader thing, and that's why I never felt good from the Niners' perspective. The whole thing was they kind of let Mahomes just kind of hang around, right? They let him hang around, and you just kind of had a feeling that at some point Mahomes is going to turn Mahomes, and you kind of go into an overtime situation. Yeah, you just don't. Their defense had been out on the field for a bunch too. To me, that wasn't really the thing, right? I just think that the Niners had to probably take advantage of kind of some of their earlier opportunities to kind of build a bigger cushion so that when, eventually Mahomes turned into Superman, that they would have enough of a cushion to kind of withstand that, So I get why people are upset. Just to me, it just didn't feel like that's what determined the outcome of the game. What'd you think?
Yeah, I've talked about it. I thought it was 50-50. I understood why they want the ball. You don't want to just give the ball back to Mahomes after your defense was on the field for a long time to finish regulation, actually stopped them from scoring a touchdown, and was banged up. You had defensive backs on the ground, and just turn around and give it right back to Mahomes. I think you're asking for a touchdown from the Chiefs, and Shanahan afterwards said he thought it was a field goal kind of game, which I sort of disagree with. I would have maybe thought about going for it on fourth and four instead of kicking the field goal, but I get what he's saying. If they could have stopped the Chiefs, scored, kicked the field goal, maybe you stop the Chiefs and make them kick a field goal because they did have third and six before one of those Mahomes scrambles. And then you get the ball and it's sudden death and you get the ball first. That was the thinking. I know a big deal has been made about the Chiefs celebrating when they found out that the 49ers were going to take the ball. I just think it's a new thing. It's a new rule. How could you know for sure? It lost. So everything you do in a loss can be scrutinized. I don't know that the howling over this is quite justified, but it's a Super Bowl. You're going to get hit. And until Shanahan and the 49ers win one of these, you're going to get scrutinized for every single time you don't. That's all understandable. It's a Super Bowl. It's 125 million people watching. Everyone's going to have an opinion. I didn't think that was a big deal. And I think the whole thing about Juszczyk and Armstead afterwards saying they didn't know all the overtime rules, that didn't change the game at all. And they just kind of said, I don't know. I mean, I don't know anybody knew all the rules. I was kind of confused there at the end. Like, what happened if time ran out in the first overtime? I knew the game wasn't over, but I wasn't 100% sure what would happen at that moment. So I just think that it's Super Bowl mania. You lose, you're going to get hit with this stuff. You win, then like your next time you go through it, you're not as scrutinized as much. They just haven't won. And Shanahan absolutely hasn't won. I just think it gets overbaked, overdone, overblown. But then they fired a defensive coordinator. So like they play into it themselves, even if that was – kind of what they might have done, even win or lose, maybe. I think Steve Wilks might have been fired even if they had won. The culture didn't match. He didn't fit with Nick Bosa. You know, bringing him down from – and Fred Warner and others – bringing him down from the booth midseason was a sign that it was not going great. That's a pretty obvious change. It's a pretty obvious – like, we got to try something here. So we'll see. And then their next guy, you know, I would imagine be more connected to the players, or they hope. And they won't be going through some struggles. So we'll see. The struggles, unlikely that we've gone through, with some of the Wi-Fi issues. Hopefully, our wonderful producer, Mike, will have fixed this all. But I think we've had some bad luck with this one. So let's jump over to the Warriors calling the Lakers about LeBron James last week. I mean, certainly a bombshell report from ESPN. Totally interesting thing. I was not surprise, because frankly, I think Joe Lacob calls about everybody. He just does. And he's called about LeBron James over the years, not expecting a thumbs up. But I also think there was some passive aggressive Lakers in this, saying, hey, LeBron, if you want to be traded, here's the Warriors, you go ahead. It's definitely a little clunky between the Lakers and LeBron, or a lot clunky. LeBron can be this way, we know. And we know the Lakers can kind of feel like, LeBron, if you really don't want to be one of us, then let's just move on. What was your read of that whole Warriors, Lakers, LeBron three-way conversation?
Yeah, you know, I think every team that's kind of worth its salt, right, will check in on star guys. You know, I mean, it's a matter of due diligence. The interesting part was that this came out, that this came publicly. I assume, you know, right, and Ramona Shelburne does a great job of covering this stuff. I assume it came out of the Lakers side.
I think your assumption's correct on that, Dylan.
And, you know, watching LeBron, there's a little bit of like A-Rod in there, right? It's this kind of passive aggressive, you know, I think there are like a lot of similarities there. And
that's,
I wouldn't be
surprised. That's a pretty good.
I wouldn't be surprised that actually, you know, similar to A-Rod, that like if LeBron kind of emerges, you know, in retirement as kind of more like a likable personality, because he's not having to kind of perform for the cameras all the time, right? I mean, he's very kind of self-conscious of the image he projects, but is almost too transparent in like wanting to like look cool all the time, you know? And yeah, it gets tiring, I think, right? And, you know, it kind of takes me back to pre-COVID, you know? There was that trade deadline where, you know, they're trying to get Anthony Davis. They couldn't get him out of New Orleans immediately. You know, LeBron gets upset. Kind of goes again on one of these passive aggressive things, you know, Jeannie Buss gets upset. I mean, to her credit, she does kind of hit that point, it seems, where, okay, you know what, like, I ultimately, like, I'm the boss, and she will kind of put her foot down. You know, she did then. To me, this kind of feels like that again. It's like, okay, well, you want to go then, you know, because I think it's this kind of weird game of chicken, right? I mean, I think LeBron knows that, you know, and this has not been a well-run organization, really. And LeBron James has, to his, you know, in his defense, really papered over a lot of things that have gone wrong here. you know, he keeps them, he guarantees that they'll be relevant, you know, after years in which they weren't, frankly, right, relevant, right? And so, you know, I think he understands what he brings, and now he's kind of saying, like, well, like, in exchange for that, like, I want, you know, you to kind of build a certain type of team around me, and which is always not always possible. I mean, at the end of the day, though, you know, one of the reasons I think there's kind of been this assumption too, right, which again, I don't think is necessarily wrong, is that he wants to be in LA, you know? And so it's like, well, you kind of can't have it both ways, right? Either, you know, if you're going to be in LA, there are going to be certain realities of just where this franchise is right now, things they can and can't do, you know, and obviously, and look, I don't blame him. He's trying to extract, you know, whatever he can to enhance his legacy. He knows he's near the end of it. Another championship obviously would be, you know, certainly another, you know, feather in his very decorated cap. You know, but I think from the Lakers standpoint, it's like, hey, we're trying to do, you know, we're bending over, you know, to serve you at every possible turn that we can. This is just something we kind of can't do right now. We can't trade everybody. And so, hey, if you want to go, go, you know, and I think it was just kind of the Lakers saying, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah. And by the way, they've done a lot of trades for him. I mean, they've done a ton of things for him. Yeah. Some good, some bad. I mean, they got Russell Westbrook because he wanted him, and that did not work out. And then LeBron's like, hey, let's get rid of this guy. Why don't you get rid of this guy? Like, LeBron, you wanted him. And there's been other players they've acquired. All the moves they made last, you know, trade deadline, which were good, which helped get them to the Western Conference Finals, beat the Warriors in six games, now aren't looking so great. And now he's like, it's just, I think that is the element here is, it's not like we've said no to you, LeBron. It's like we've traded a whole lot of people for you, a whole lot of draft picks. Maybe some of them weren't the greatest moves, and maybe some things the Lakers have done outside of LeBron haven't been great, coaching hires, whatever. But like, you, we're doing the stuff that you asked us to do, and to, you know, throw up your arms in exasperation. Like, take some accountability for this, LeBron. Like, take some. Like, okay, maybe some of the things I wanted weren't the greatest, and let's see what you can do. And the owner does have to think about 2029 and 2030 and all these picks that he's so happy to trade off. I get that he doesn't care about it, but it's hard to like stomp your feet and say, oh, they want to, you know, they won't mortgage their entire future after I'm gone. Well, at some point, like, they do have to look about that.
I think it's one thing too, honestly, had he taken accountability for the Westbrook thing, mm-hmm. you know, which he did, you know, I can't remember kind of, I remember late in that season, you know, I asked him basically about that. Well, I mean, you were part of this thing, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you know, I'm just a player here. You know? I mean, sure, they might have asked.
He's just a player. Come on, Dylan.
It was kind of along the lines of, like, sure, they might have asked me for my opinion. But, you know, ultimately, this was not my call, you know. And it's kind of like, okay, come on, man, you know. And that's where, again, right, it's I think if it's a guy that kind of, like, owns it, right, you know, the guy that's out there, you know, saying, hey, you know what, we lost. I'm the best player on the team. It's my fault. I think it might be a little bit easier to stomach. But like in this case, again, it's kind of A-Roddy, right? So, you know, the one thing, though, is right, is like in terms of, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kind of super team, you know, right? When they're young, it's a super team. When it's a bunch of old guys getting together, it turns into kind of like a Frankenstein experiment. But like, this would have been like the ultimate. Right. I mean, the two best players of this era, Steph and LeBron.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same team. How do you think that would have worked out?
Yeah. I think it might have been okay for a short term. The fascinating thing is LeBron's so different than Steph, or should we say Steph is so different than LeBron. He's like, he does have opinions. He does like quietly, like, you know, advise on things, but he will admit when, you know what, I kind of wanted that guy and maybe I was wrong. Like, he will do that. He will, like, some things I wanted and now turns out these other guys are good. Like, there was much more like, I've seen what happened, and, you know, or there are times where he wanted something and it would have worked out if they did it his way. But he's very logical about it, right? He's very rational about it for a superstar. He's the most rational superstar I've ever covered. He's not passive aggressive. He just doesn't play those games. Whatever he's going to do with, you know, with Joe Lacob, with Steve Kerr, with Mike Dunleavy Jr. in the past, with Bob Myers. Like, you do go to him. You should go to him, but he's not demanding things. He's not, certainly not tweeting hourglasses and, you know, eyes emojis and all those things. So to put him with LeBron, which are very opposite people, you know, in concurrent era have competed against each other, would be fascinating. But like Steph's the guy that everyone can play with. Kevin Durant comes in there and you can work with him. Things would have been different. I'm not sure how that would have fit with Draymond, or, you know, and clearly Clutch was part of this. So it's not like Draymond would have been traded for him. Maybe it would have been Chris Paul plus someone else, but also you'd want Chris Paul with you know, LeBron, because that's the whole banana boat buddies. So I'm not sure, you know, maybe it would have been Clay, whatever. I don't think it ever came close, whatever names you throw out there, Kuminga and Clay, whatever it would have been. But I think Steph and Draymond would have, you know, worked to have this, you know, not be terribly, you know, uncomfortable, at least for a year. I don't know what he would have done after this season. He has a player option and he may or may not exercise that in LA. I assume he will, or at least renegotiate, get a new deal. I don't know what would have happened if he was with the Warriors. I don't know that any of that was all the way thought out. I just think the Warriors thought, okay, if he wants out and we can exchange Klay Thompson's contract for him, you know, I mean, that's how is that a losing situation? I did ask Steph about it a couple of days ago. And he's like, you know, you never know all the stuff that's going on. Like he was hinting like this conversation happens a lot. It just doesn't happen to get reported because the other team doesn't often, you know, talk about it or theoretically talk about it. We don't know that's where it came from, but I'll just say, I don't think it came from the Warriors, but like, hey, it's LeBron. Like, you know, what are you going to do? Not call? I mean, it's kind of, if LeBron was up for it and the Lakers would have done it and you could do, you know, Moses Moody, Klay Thompson, and a first round pick for LeBron James, you do it. So I just think that it's just a very interesting kind of comparison of two franchises, comparison of two legendary players, where you certainly weren't talking about trading Steph Curry to the Lakers, right? That phone call would never happen. It wouldn't happen. And the fact that it did happen, it got all the way to LeBron's people talking, you know, with Joe Lacob or whoever they talked to, because Jeannie said, go ahead and call him. I mean, it's just an interesting situation. You would never, not never, but it would not have gotten to the point where the Lakers would even feel like they could acquire Steph Curry. Like that wouldn't have happened. Yet it was to the point where the Warriors had a conversation with LeBron's representatives, whether he wanted to be traded, and Jeannie Buss was okay with that conversation. Just an interesting way to think about this. Yeah. Durant joined Steph, right? Steph didn't join Durant. You know, it's an interesting way to look at who Steph Curry is and who the Warriors are, that it's always them trying to get these players. They would love to have Giannis. They would, you know, they wanted Anthony Davis. Like, it's never Steph or Draymond. There, sometimes Draymond's talked to other teams, but it's never been serious. Go joining other teams. And I just think that's the way I look at it. Maybe that should have been a column at some point. It's just a fascinating way to look at these two careers. LeBron's the one that's gone from Cleveland to Miami, back to Cleveland, to the Lakers. Been incredible. Best player of this era, maybe the best player ever. But Steph Curry has never been, other than teams like going, God, it would be great to have Steph, but there's never been a moment where you thought that the Warriors would say, okay, you want to go? Go. That's just never happened. And I don't think it's going to happen. And that's how I look at this one big picture.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of when you talk about, right, I know a lot of times like sports writers like me like to throw out the word culture, you know, out there a lot. And what does that mean exactly? Right. I mean, and that's, you know, Steph obviously is a big part of that culture. Right. I mean, like you said, right.
He is the culture. You know,
You know, but, you know, part of it is that it's that, though. Right. It's kind of the personalities on the team kind of combined with kind of this larger framework. Right. And, you know, they're obviously kind of like you said, like it, Golden State, it's working out, you know, Lakers here, this thing is very fragile, you know. Yep. You know, I know my colleague Bill Plaschke has kind of been pushing, get rid of LeBron. But like, man, you know what that's going to look like?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're going to love this segue. They're going to turn into the Angels without Shohei Ohtani.
Not ever. They're never going to be the Angels. Never going to be the Angels. Not that low. Come on. First, you compare LeBron to A-Rod, and now you're comparing the Lakers to the Angels.
Jesus. A-Rod was a great player, man. Generational talent.
Oh, my. Yeah, really, really popular guy, too. Really popular guy. LeBron's got a few more championships than A-Rod, but I hear what you're saying, and it is like the Austin Reeves era of the Lakers might not be the prettiest in the whole world. I don't even know who else they would have long-term there. If LeBron goes, who's long-term? It's Austin Reeves and because I would imagine AD would be like the next one out. Like, I mean, there's just, I don't know if you keep AD if LeBron's around, and I'm trying to think who would be on this team. Jalen Hood-Schifino? Who else would be on this team?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I think that they would almost have to kind of build around AD though. Right now, maybe
he's didn't like it in New Orleans when he was doing that. So, and he's older now. I don't know. Maybe it would be
have trouble getting, you know, this is the thing too, though. It's like, you know, you kind of forget that between, you know, like Kobe or even before Kobe was even gone. Right. I mean, they were having trouble getting like interviews with guys.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they, right. I think when Durant signed with Golden State, I mean, he wouldn't even talk to the Lakers. He
wouldn't talk to them.
You know?
No.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, this is not, you know, again, it's, you pull that LeBron pin out of this thing, that whole thing unravels. It's going to be bad, you know. And look, Davis is at a point in his career, you know, he kind of is who he is. He's going to miss a chunk of games every single year. You know, in terms of like the type of money, is that right? Is that elsewhere? I don't know. Like, he might, you know, the realities at this point might just be, you know, for the lack of a better term, he's almost kind of stuck here.
Yeah. You know what the Lakers would think if LeBron moves on, let's say he doesn't pick up that option. They think they'll go get someone else. Like, yeah. And maybe they would. Like, they're the Lakers, right? They are a team of statues, a team of Hall of Famers, a team of, you know, you just, people grow up wanting to play for the Lakers. But I don't know who that player would be.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? I mean, because they were talking, you know, right? There was, you know, you'd kind of hear just kind of in the hallways, right? You know, old Luka, whatever. Well, long-term deal now. Giannis, whatever. Same thing, right? And so all these guys are kind of getting snapped up now, and yeah, who's that guy?
I got one for them. Paul George. How about Paul George? I mean, that's not a superstar, but you know, already in LA. Well, we'll see. This is we could have done a whole show on it. We should have started on this. This is good stuff. since we're the Ohtani, unofficial Ohtani podcast, and you are the, I'm putting you on, like, you are the official Ohtani documenter. And you are, again, you are a personal hero of people in Japan. I know you are a hero to my people. To our people, you were in Arizona for the Ohtani first spring training moments. You've written about it. We've talked about, like, what's that clubhouse going to be like? What's the, you know, just the players seeing all the media and just the fuss that Ohtani brings to him. I read your stuff. You seem impressed by the way things have been handled and the way that Ohtani's handling it. What did you see? What did you feel out there in the Dodgers spring training?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's him plus everybody else. Right. You know, and actually, and maybe this kind of illustrates kind of the level to where this is at, you know, as before I sat down to write the most recent column that I wrote, the guy that I called was Henry Schulman to ask him about to ask about the Giants era, you know, the Bonds era Giants, right, where you had one, now obviously much different personalities, and kind of here, right, Ohtani, you know, in Japanese, they call it like reading the air, you know, kind of like reading the room. This guy's really sharp. He's also very kind of likable. He, you know, he doesn't mind laughing at himself. He's got a nice smile, which, as stupid as it sounds, I think I've said this before, I think it matters like a lot in this country, right? It projects a certain warmth, you know, and even a guy, I think, like, you know, because I kind of wonder privately, you know, how guys like Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman are feeling now, right? I mean, they were taking batting practice on one field the other day. Ohtani shows up to take BP on the other. All the fans that were at the Freeman Betts field ran to the other, right? I mean, at this point, it's like they're minor leaguers, you know. At some point, you know, Betts and Freeman, to kind of get to the locker room, had to cut through the field that Ohtani was hitting on. No reaction. Yeah. No reaction, you know. And it really is kind of Ohtani and then kind of everybody else. I mean, the locker room and the Dodgers spring training clubhouse is pretty spacious. But there were probably a good, you know, I mean, on the peak day, there were probably like 80 reporters in there, right? When the local LA TV stations all kind of came in at once, right? I think so. We had like four or five local TV stations, plus all the Japanese stations, all the Japanese media. Yeah, players aren't really going in there. Right. You know, when they caught Mookie at his locker one day, I mean, it turned into, you know, a 60 person scrum. Right. A lot of these kind of, right. I mean, Tim, you've done these, right. The start of spring training, you know, where's your head? How are you, you know, where are you type of stories that would have been, frankly, based on like one-on-one interviews, you know, you can't, the windows of getting these guys are so small now. Even though I was asking a lot of these questions, say to like Walker Buehler or Mookie Betts, it was a one-on-one, it felt like a one-on-one interview that was witnessed by 60 people, you know? And while obviously as a reporter, I don't like that because it's almost like you're kind of doing everyone's work for them, you kind of didn't really have a choice at this point, right? You know, the PR staff was so overwhelmed. Again, usually when I come in, I'll tell them, I want this guy, I want this guy, I want this guy. We'll kind of set up times and stuff. They've got so much other stuff to worry about that that's not even possible. You know, so there is this kind of, it's very overwhelmingly just kind of Ohtani's a star. There's everybody else. You know, but kind of the latest thing that I wrote was just that because he's so likable, right? Maybe they can kind of, it makes this easier to navigate, right? Because the thing is like a guy like Bonds that like, you know, people are either like afraid of or just kind of like downright dislike, right? You kind of wonder, why do we have to do all this for like this guy? Ohtani's at least kind of likable enough to where I think, you know, people are kind of starting to soften, right? I led the previous, you know, my most recent column with how, you know, Freddie Freeman was telling a story about how his son met Ohtani at an All-Star game a few years ago. And after Ohtani signed, the first thing Ohtani asked him is, hey, how's Charlie? You know, not just that he didn't just remember the, you know, that he had a son that he met, but he also remembered the kid's name, you know. And I can tell you, like, as a parent, like little things like that matter a lot, right?
Yep,
I
mean, sure,
you know, and so I think, you know, he's kind of you know, he's gotten along a lot really well with Teoscar Hernandez, of all people. You know, which I guess kind of when you look at it, it kind of makes sense, right? Usually the Latin guys tend to be a little bit more, you know, friendly and less like status conscious, you know, so they're kind of chatting it up. And I think for the most part, right, except for like as far as like when they're interacting with them, he's kind of like a fairly normal, down to earth guy, right? He doesn't kind of, you know. But you were around during those like Bonds era, right? I mean, I was there a little bit too, not probably as much as you were, but what do you kind of remember about that?
When I met, it was never a warm relationship, but remember there's like Bonds when he was great before the steroid stuff and then Bonds with the steroid stuff with the home run chase. So you had, it wasn't just like media attention. It was scrupulous media attention. It was aggravated media attention. It was, you know, you guys are just doing this because you hate me, you know, and, you know, whatever elements of the personalities back and forth. It was a lot of extra stuff with that one. But like, if we can try to separate some of the steroid stuff, the Balco stuff, yeah, it was a guy who did not want to be hanging around with his teammates. Frank, he just did not, who had a bad relationship with Jeff Kent, you know, the second best player on that team. Now, Kent had his own issues. Kent was one of those weird baseball weirdos, you know, so I'm not trying to say that he was representative of everything. But no, it definitely felt like a separation, and that Bonds had his own rules, never took the team picture, like never, like stuff like that. And it was just a million little things that Bonds would do. He would sleep in his, you know, had his own chair, you know, recliner, and would sleep in there in the clubhouse, and then you tiptoe around him. And then sometimes he would want to talk to the media. Sometimes he wouldn't. And that creates a mood, right? And Dusty Baker, when he was the manager, did a pretty good job of trying to balance that out, but understanding how great Bonds was as a player. And you accepted that. But I do think that, yeah, the personality does matter. Now, listen, if there's all this hubbub around Ohtani's not helping the team, I think that would change the mood in there. And I'm curious how, you know, Yamamoto is in through all this. Is he's like ignored, or is he just part of the Ohtani scene? But with Bonds, it was just such a separation. It was Bonds over there who often wouldn't talk, who often, you know, the other players had to try to explain because he was being so gruff, and they didn't particularly love him themselves, but they loved what he helped them so much as a player, that you had this divide. Clear divide of Bonds is separate, everyone else is over there. I think from what I'm hearing, what I'm just seeing, Ohtani will try not to do that. There will be some of that. He has his routine, especially like when he's pitching, maybe right now it's just a hitter, it can be more relaxed because he won't have the pitching routine to go through. But man, when he has the pitching routine and the hit, that might be a little stratifying. I think it kind of was with the Angels, but with Bonds it was, he wanted that stratification. He wanted everyone to know, I'm Barry Bonds, and motherfuckers, you're not. You're not Barry Bonds. And that over, you know, day after day after day of a long baseball season of media having to try to deal with that too, and then having to deal with the other players, really, really accumulates. And then you add the Balco stuff, you know, that just dropped on them, in this already tense situation. It just made it outlandish. It made it really bad to deal with. And I don't think it's a total shock that they did not win, you know, a lot of games, and they won decent amount, but they didn't win any World Series. They went to a World Series against the Angels. They lost it. That was pre most of the Balco stuff, and the Balco stuff drops on them. Bonds keeps having great years, and they did not have great teams. They did not. And then Canton has to go, and they, you know, they shuffle all these other people in there, just kind of built around Barry, and it wore on people. It wore on the franchise, the things you have to do. And I've told this story. And he was older by the time that he was a free agent, and they announced that he wasn't coming back. That last home game, after, you know, battling, you know, the PR people were battling with me and other people. We were being unfair. It was pretty small time. It was small time. The Giants they're not a small time operation. They're acting small time about that because they had to defend this false notion that Barry was one of everybody. We go after that game, we all ended up at a bar across the street, and it was like members of the organization, the media, and it was like a party. Like
I was there.
Remember?
They threw me out because it was my first year on the Dodger beat. The Dodgers were out. Mm-hmm. They told me, hey, just like, it was weird. Like I didn't think I made pregame availability. He's like, mm-hmm. just get up there. Forget about it. Dodgers are out. Yeah. And everybody was there. It was nuts.
It was
a really good time, actually.
It was unbelievable. It was the best time I've had around Giants people. I've had good times with Giants writers, but Giants, like the Giants PR person is not there anymore. Hasn't been there for a long time. It was like buying drinks. I'll put it that way. Who I did not get along, and I do not get along with. And we had major issues over the Bond stuff. I thought he was being small timer, not understanding the bigger picture. I wasn't taking personal shots at the team. I was just taking the shots at them for enabling this guy and through all the steroid stuff. But then it just kind of, there was this release. There were players there, Dylan. There were like players there. And it was just like, it's over. Now, listen, they weren't going to be a very good team, but the fact is they won a World Series like 3 years later. Like they had to get past that situation to let the Buster Posey, Bumgarner, Lincecum era really take over. Now, Lincecum was on that team, by the way. He was a young player on that team. It had to turn over to Lincecum. They were lucky to have a player like Lincecum ready to go. Then they signed Barry Zito and whatever, all the other stuff. But that moment is ingrained in my head. And I didn't realize you were there, Dylan. But it was an unbelievable
everybody,
moment.
Everybody was there.
Yeah, so. It was a release. It was an incredible release of just like, we went through this. We didn't like each other maybe through it, but we're now past it. And let's go to the next thing and celebrate that the old thing is gone. I don't expect there to be that kind of thing around Otani, but that's what the Bonds thing was like. And you know, the Balco thing really made everything worse. It was just very difficult and poor. You know, Shulman, he had his other Chronicle reporters breaking all the Balco stuff, and Henry was the one who had to talk to the guy, to Barry, and ask him the questions. And it was unfair to Henry. It really was. I thought the Balco, you know, some of them, my friends, should have been in there. They never set foot in the clubhouse, never once. And I thought it was very unfair to Henry. He took the bulk of it, and he had known, you know, he knew Bonds a long time, and that, you know, was a not a good situation. And I think the reporters who are reporting it should have been in there. And I'll say it, and they'll probably get mad at me for saying it. But I thought that was grossly unfair to Henry Shulman. But he did it. He went through it, and my respect to him for doing it. Hank Shulman. How about that? A-Rod, Hank Shulman, LeBron, all the greats are being referenced here.
I got a quick ref, you know, kind of what you said, you know, like Bonds wanting to say, you know, like make it clear, I'm Barry Bonds, right? You know, and Otani, if anything, kind of like, makes efforts, it feels, to like lower himself, right? And you know, I saw like on social media last night there was a team-wide chicken wing eating contest. You know, he showed up to that. You know, I asked Roberts if he would kind of subject you know, Otani to kind of the first year player like hazing thing where you know, like they have like a talent show. Roberts is like, oh, I'm not gonna make him do anything. I wouldn't be surprised if he participated in that. And this just kind of reminds me of a funny story that you know, when I went to go visit his high school years ago, you know, the players there live like in a dorm, right? They're there, they get to go home. This is nuts, man. They, so, you know, they live in these dorms. Now, most of them are from the prefecture, but it's still like home might be 30-minute train ride away, right? So everybody lives there. I think they told me players generally went home maybe 5 days a year. Otherwise, they like lived in this dorm 24 hours. And yeah, the pitchers on the team, the coach would make them clean the toilets. That was their duty, you know, and his thing was, hey, during the game, you're on the most elevated, you're literally on the most elevated stage, you know, after the game, you're the one that the media is going to want to talk to. So during the other times, you need to kind of like lower yourself, you know, and take care of like the fundamental things that are kind of important, right? And I've never heard anybody speak so philosophically about toilets, but he said, you know, if you walk into an establishment and you go into the bathroom, you can tell what type of establishment it is, right? If the toilets are kind of dirty, you kind of can tell like, okay, this is just like a mid place, right? Any place that takes itself seriously and holds itself to a high standards have immaculately clean toilets, you know? And so again, right, that's kind of, you know, that was the environment under which like Ohtani spent his formative years. So, you know, again, my expectation is that he will, you know, metaphorically be cleaning toilets this year to everybody
wow.
else.
Wow. Wow. That's a nice metaphor. That's a good one. By the way, I agree with that guy. I agree with that coach. Like that, you go to a restaurant and there's a sloppy, bad bathroom. You're like going, what the hell are they doing everywhere else? Like,
oh, and actually, yeah, another Bay Area tie-in here. So that coach, his name is Hiroshi Sasaki. His son, Rintaro Sasaki, last year broke the all-time Japanese high school national record for home runs. Just signed with Stanford University.
Wow.
So that's kind of an interesting path here, right? He was a projected first-round pick in Japan. Obviously, you know, if he had wanted to come to the United States and sign with a major league organization right away, he could have done that. You know, my understanding is part of the thinking is, you know, I guess if he keeps Japanese residency, he won't have to be subjected to the draft, you know. Right. If you sign with a minor league team, I think they understand here, you know, there's enough of an understanding in Japan that, you know, they're going to send you out into some really rural environment. Right. You might live with like a family or something, you know, only be surrounded by other baseball players, might not be the best place necessarily to become acclimated to like America, you know, in the English language and the American culture. You know, here he could do it like in a school setting. So it's going to be really interesting to kind of see how that unfolds there. But there is kind of an old tiny tie in there now at Stanford. So. Real quick, also, you know, again, I'm planning to advertise this podcast now to all of the great fans in Japan. I've noticed like in the last week, you know,
we love
tell them a little bit about you maybe and how the Kawakamis became kind of an important family here, right, in the Bay Area. No, really, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, quite. I mean, listen, I'm a third generation Japanese American. My parents are both second generation. Their parents were the ones who moved from Japan, immigrated like 1890s. But my father grew up in Salt Lake City, working in the salt mines. My mother is part of a very, very big, strong family in San Francisco, the Abe family. So. I have a lot of San Francisco, like the community, the post-World War II community that really built up strong, basically helped build, you know, Japantown in San Francisco, the post-war culture, the assimilated Japanese, maintaining the character. That's my mother's side. And my mother's father, my grandfather, who I never knew died during the war, was a newspaper editor and, you know, started the first Japanese American newspaper, I think, in California. And, you know, that's where probably I get some of my writing. We'll see. But that family, the Abe family, very, very important family in San Francisco, had been. I'm not part of that. You know, we're a little bit away from that now, but with strong ties to this community. And the Kawakami family, you might know that my dad married, and then when they got married from the church, the Pine United Methodist Church, very important church in the Japanese community. And there's a lot of Kawakamis out there now, four boys, my two older brothers, one younger, grandkids, all these things. The name is out there, and we're very proud of it. But it's also the Abe family on my mother's side, and we're very proud of this family. My father died a little while ago, so a lot of reminiscing, a lot of talking about that. His, you know, all his brothers and sisters, and my mom's sisters and brothers, very important generation. That post-war generation, you know, many of them out of the camps. My mom was in a relocation camp when she was very young. And coming out of that and establishing a community in the Bay Area, you know, San Jose, very strong Japanese-American community. Walnut Creek, strong Japanese-American community. And San Francisco, for sure, Japanese-American community. So it's very, very important. I know friends with, you know, the Japanese Community Cultural Center and based in San Francisco is huge. I do a lot of stuff with them. So, this Japanese connection is real. It's in my blood, obviously. And it's in your blood too, Dylan. That's what we got. You know, you are part of this community. People, I tell people still, like, Dylan is a fluent Japanese speaker. Like, what? And it's like, it's very, very, it's great that you have this, you're so, you know, all these extra layers to yourself. I don't speak Japanese. It's very poorly on my part. We just never learned it. Again, that was part of the post-war. You don't want to speak Japanese, right? You just were in camps for being of Japanese heritage. So, you know, my parents, a little bit, but were encouraged not to speak that much Japanese. So, of course, I grew up not speaking any Japanese. But Dylan Hernandez can, and you can go to those Japanese press conferences and you can speak to a Japanese audience. And let's emphasize that. Let's underline that. In Ohtani coverage, this is your guy who's going to be able to straddle both worlds. And there's great value in that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of times I think people in Japan, right, will kind of look at those of us that grew up on this side, right, and it's kind of, well, they're just Americans, right? No, but there is, no. I think, though, you know, right, there's certain, I think, kind of fundamental traits that do get passed down from, you know, generation to generation. There is like this kind of common ancestry. And sometimes I do think that they, you know, a lot of people in Japan will kind of look at us, frankly, right? And, you know, right, like, especially you and I, our personalities, like, man, how can somebody be this bold, right? Yeah. You know, but that's the thing, too, though, right, is this is in them, too, in a way, right? It's just kind of, right, our families came here, we adapted to whatever the situation was, you know, and obviously, I think, kind of, right, whatever we do is kind of in a way an extension.
We'll explain your background, Dylan. We'll explain your background, Dylan.
So my dad is he was born in El Salvador, kind of moved here when he was 10, kind of, right? He went to Belmont High School. His best friend actually played in the big leagues for like 10 years, Louis Gomez. He played a lot for the Braves and the Twins. My mother is like Japanese. She didn't come here until she was like in her mid-20s. They were both living in L.A. at the time because my mother basically came here to she was a nurse in Japan, studied abroad for a year. The story they tell me was that they were both on vacation in Mexico and they met on a tour bus there. Haven't tried to grill them too much on the details. I have a feeling the story might fall apart.
Don't raise any questions. Your parents. Don't question them.
No, you don't want that. But yeah,
that's the next podcast. Yeah. Investigating the story of Dylan's parents.
But my mom is like Japanese. Now that says she's from like rural Japan, right? She's from Niigata, just only rice fields there. But yeah, she kind of made it a point to kind of really raise us in the culture. I went to a Saturday Japanese school called Asahi Gakuen, and it was like, you know, this is during the 80s, so it's mostly for kids whose parents were here like on business for like 2-3 years, and because education is standardized nationally in Japan, it was for kids. You know, again, so that when they went back to Japan, they could just slide in. Pretty much everybody that I went to school with ended up back in Japan, including the guy that was covering Darvish, Wataru Serizawa, was actually a classmate of mine here. And we met years later covering you, Darvish. So who knew, you know?
training ground, Dylan Hernandez.
Yeah, I don't know why my mom sent me there. It was terrible. You know, they would hit you if you messed around.
Teach a little discipline.
That was part of it, right? So, but yeah, so that's a little bit more of, you know, so I kind of grew up in the culture a bit. So, yeah, so that's been kind of helpful here, you know.
A little bit. Yeah, just a little bit, Dylan. Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway. Listen, if there's anybody who is tuning in because of this, I appreciate it. I hope that we would give good information from what we know. Perspective, you're going to be on the scene. I might come down there. We'll see. And anything else in the Bay Area from our vantage points, which are, you know, can be from all, you know, from American viewpoint, from Japanese American viewpoint, from, you know, all kinds of different viewpoints. And hopefully that it's valuable in some sort of way. And I'm glad that we both can present these differing viewpoints, hopefully in an interesting and opinionated and reported and analytical and all these other ways. But that's what we're trying to do with North and South. And I think Dylan can, you can vault it out into the Japanese ether, the media ether. And I think that would do good for everybody.
So quick greeting for the people of Japan. Nihonominasan, yoroshiku
omegaishimasu. Awesome. Keep going. Keep going. I love it. And by the way, you've made me hungry for chicken wings. You made that chicken wing reference. I'm going to have some.
That sounds good.
Yeah, yeah, it does sound good. Right. I got some. Actually, I've got some. So I'm going to eat some very, very soon. All right. We had some technical difficulties. We're hoping it can be patched through. It's been great for the last 20 minutes. So I think we're clean on this. We'll see how that first part goes through. But Dylan, this was a good one. This was a good one. Let's keep going with this.
All right. Let's keep going.
Yeah, I had to unplug my hard line in order to do this. But if we got to do it that way, let's do it. I'm running out of power because of that, but that's okay.
Adaptability.
Yeah, we
that's the word of the day.
Moving around. I'm not just sitting in my recliner telling you to just do but what I do. We have to move it around and make it what's best for the team. All right, everybody. That is the North and South for this week. Thanks, everybody.